Up until the 16th century in Europe, divisions in the Christian church between believers and non-believers, or between different flavors of Christianity, would mostly be described as forms of tribalism, with a significant and persistent hostility and racism towards Jews. But beginning in the 1500s, we see an explosion of what can only be called blatant racism towards non-white people. And today we'll talk about why that was and still is today in some Christian communities. And I should also mention, to keep this balance, that next time we'll look at some of the many Christian heroes of anti-racism and highlight some important Christian activists who dedicated their lives in the fight against injustice and people of color, specifically because of their Christian beliefs. To begin with, let's try to understand how the community of saints, the fellowship of those who claimed to be disciples of the one who taught tolerance and acceptance and love for everyone, how they could become hostile towards and felt superior to what they considered to be inferior races. Let's begin in 2 Samuel 7, 23 to 24. Samuel says, "And what one nation on earth is like your people Israel, whom God went to redeem for himself as a people, to make a name for himself, to do a great thing for you, Israel, and awesome things for your land? Before your people, whom you, God, have redeemed for yourself from Egypt, from nations and their gods. For you, God, have established for yourself your people, Israel, as your own people forever. You, O Lord, have become their God." There's something very, very special and privileged about the nation of Israel in the scriptures, especially in what we call the Old Testament. Of course, those same scriptures were written by the Hebrew people themselves, so it's only natural that they would reflect a very positive relationship between themselves and their God. Throughout the scriptures, descendants of Israel are, quote, loved forever, unquote, chosen and favored people. And you could imagine how that self-identity would influence not just their view of their own specialness, but also of their superiority to all other nations. Let's read also in Isaiah 60, verses 1 to 3. It says, "Arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord rises upon you." This is a very special, intimate relationship, on only on you. Isaiah says, "See, take a look, darkness covers the earth, and thick darkness is over all peoples. But the Lord rises upon you, Israel, and his glory appears over you. You are a light. Nations will come to your light, and kings to the brightness of your dawn." Israel was destined to be a light to the Gentile nations, a leader, an example, a forerunner of how all nations would be blessed in the future when they eventually all came under the rulership of Yahweh. Jesus reinforces this concept when we read in Matthew 5, 14 to 16. He tells a gathered crowd listening to his sermon on the mountainside, "You are the salt of the earth, and you are the light of the world." Now please notice, Jesus is not speaking to Christians. This is not even said to any particular followers of Jesus. This is said to Jews. Jesus is reinforcing what Isaiah said, that all Jewish people ought to be a beacon of light to the Gentiles. But then we find a radical transition for the Apostle Paul, since the Jewish leaders had insisted on the execution of the Messiah, the light of the world is no longer the Jewish people. It is his gospel. In 2 Corinthians 4:6, "For God, who said, 'Let light shine out of darkness,'" that is both in creation, and also, as we've just seen in Isaiah, that is his light shining upon his people, that same God now has made his light shine in our hearts to give us, the followers of the Messiah, the light of the knowledge of God's glory displayed in the face of Christ. It is often said in Christian circles that we have no light of ourselves, but we are light bearers, that is, that we reflect the good news of the glory of God as seen in Jesus the Christ. But there's a very fine line between feeling favorably blessed or called and believing that you are closer to God, more right with God, and at least in some sense superior to others who hold inferior beliefs to yours. From the 16th century onwards, pockets of pseudo-theologians have proposed the idea that true Christians are the people of the kingdom and directly related to ancient Israelites. Thus, the gospel of the kingdom is the good news that true physical descendants of Abraham are those inhabiting the true church. British and American Israelism blurred the lines of physical and spiritual Israel, and blurred the lines between being a blessed people and being racially superior to the degree that other races were believed to be available for exploitation, enslavement, or even eradication. So again, how is it that any racist ideologies could find such a pervasive and established foothold in Christianity? Well, actually, these ideologies easily find their justification in the fundamentalist application of biblical scriptures from ancient societies and applied to the modern world, or misapplied to the modern world. And I, like some of you, grew up with or were exposed to some of these ideas. What do I mean by fundamentalist? What is a fundamentalist? And why are they so dangerous? Fundamentalism is the belief in the original form of a religion, belief, or theory without accepting any later ideas, regardless of what science, archaeology, or cultural historical insights might bring to light. It is the belief that every word of the Bible is divinely inspired and therefore true, morally good, and cannot be changed, and it is not open to any form of interpretation. God said it, I believe it, that settles it. And of course, there are many types of fundamentalist beliefs that all contradict each other, each one believing that they know what God said and what God meant. But the news is, and it's probably not news, most fundamentalists are fake. They don't read the Bible as the whole word of God. They leave bits out, they choose bits they don't like and discard them and say they're done away with, or they've been replaced, or they're no longer valid, or that was for a different time. And they find creative ways to adapt and adjust and put into a different context the bits they don't like. Either circumcision is an everlasting covenant or it isn't. The Bible and the Word of God says it is. Either it is a shame for a woman to have short hair or it isn't. The Bible and the Word of God says it is. Either wiping out the inhabitants, men, women, and babies, is approved by God if he wants you to have a promised land, or it isn't. The Bible and the Word of God suggest that it is. It's easy to pick the bits of scriptures that you like and make your own religion out of what's left. and feel justified in committing all sorts of atrocities, including racism. So let's look briefly at four racist ideologies from the last 500 years that found a home in parts, sometimes relatively isolated parts, but significant parts of the Christian landscape. Ideologies whose justification and defense were found in a fundamentalist reading of the scriptures. The first is manifest destiny. Manifest destiny is a phrase that was coined in 1845. It is the idea that the United States is destined by God to expand its dominion and spread not just Christianity, but democracy and capitalism across the entire North American continent. Manifest destiny was also clearly a racial doctrine of white supremacy that granted no Native American or non-white claims to any permanent possession of any of the lands on the North American continent. Tracing the path of manifest destiny across the West would highlight mass destruction of tribal organizations, confinement of Indians to reservations, and full-blown genocide. In the Bible, wars of extermination were sanctioned against local inhabitants who stood in the way of God's chosen people. Speaking of Joshua's war with the city of Hazor, the Bible tells us in Joshua 11:11, they smote or killed all the souls that were therein with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying them. There was not any left to breathe, and he burnt Hazor with fire. It should be noted that the Lord's gift, quote unquote, of new territory and the actions taken by the Hebrews to acquire it was justified on the grounds, that this might sound familiar, on the grounds that the indigenous inhabitants were savages, idolaters, cannibals, and human sacrificers, neither civilized nor of the true faith. The second ideology is British Israelism. British Israelism is the belief that the people of the British Isles are genetically, racially, and linguistically the direct descendants of the 10 lost tribes of Israel. Some adherents further claim that the British royal family is of lineal descent from the house of King David via a daughter of Zedekiah, the last king of Judah. Apparently, according to the legend, they traveled to Ireland where one of the surviving Judahite princesses, Tia Tefi, no such person, married a local high king of Ireland. From this fabled union, the Davidic throne was supposedly preserved, having been transferred to Ireland, then Scotland, and later England, because the English stole it, from which the British monarchs are alleged to have descended. The creation of British Israelism was inspired by numerous ideological factors, which included a desire of its adherents, whom many were from ordinary backgrounds, to prove that they had a glorious past. Secondly, there was an emerging pride in Western imperialism and colonialism, and this fit with that. And thirdly, a belief in the racial superiority of white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. British Israelism served as a justification for British imperialism and American settler colonialism, along with the displacement of the indigenous peoples. Third is apartheid. Apartheid means separateness. It was a system of institutionalized racial segregation and oppression in South Africa and Southwest Africa from 1948 up until early 1900s. Within this system of social stratification, white citizens had the highest status, followed by Indians and coloreds, and then black Africans at the bottom. According to Alex Ryrie in his book Protestants, The Faith That Made the Modern World, apartheid was not a form of fascism, but a form of Calvinism. The theology of apartheid was based on the principle that separateness is God's will. And it is easy to conclude that not only nations themselves, but cultures are created by God. And it is their duty to preserve those cultures in their distinct and separate state to the glory of God who created them. In 1931, the Afrikaans Orange Free State called for black churches to be established on their own terrain, separated and apart, as part of a community that, quote, shall take care of its own economic life apart from, yet where possible, in cooperation with the white community. Interracial marriage was forbidden, and just as the Jews had in the Book of Ezra been saved by a rigid prohibition on marrying Gentiles, so South Africa's many nations ought to be preserved in their individual purities from the dangers of, quote, mongrelization. Fourth and last but not least, Ku Klux Klan. The original KKK had been a terrorist movement in the American South in the late 1860s, whose members, dressed as, you've seen what they wear, those are the ghosts of dead Confederate war soldiers. And they were meant to, they dressed like that to intimidate and murder newly freed black slaves and northerners. It was revived in 1915 by a former Methodist minister in Georgia and turned itself into a movement campaigning for white America against Jews, Catholics, immigrants, communists, and especially blacks, basically expressing moral Christian outrage against everyone who wasn't white and Protestant. Those who supported the Klansmen believed that they were the future, the spearhead of a new reformation through which Protestantism and the white race would triumph. Its hooded members believed themselves to be knights, defending Christianity and Southern womanhood. Its initiation ceremony included a quasi-baptism and a rewritten evangelical hymn. Klansmen were urged to model themselves after Christ and to give 10% of their income as a tithe to, quote-unquote, humanitarian service. Unfortunately, there is actually a claimed biblical justification for all of this, for racial segregation, for racism, for apartheid, for KKK, for manifest destiny, all of it. I want to read from Deuteronomy 7, verses 1 to 6. It says, when the Lord, speaking to the new nation of Israel coming into the promised land, when the Lord your God brings you into the land that you're entering to possess and drives out before you many nations, the Blackfoot, the Sioux, the Ojibwe, could be the same thing. When they drive out before you the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, seven nations larger and stronger than you who were living there peacefully for some considerable time with a developed culture, family structure, permanent settlements. And when the Lord your God has delivered them over to you, that means when he's allowed you to win in battle to kill them, and you have defeated them, then you must not just defeat them, but you must destroy them totally. They can't live there anymore. They can't exist anymore. They can't just be your neighbors somewhere else. But it goes beyond this. In case you were thinking of you could just win the battles and try to work out an arrangement to live together in peace and harmony and love, it says, make no treaty with them and show them no mercy. In other words, do not negotiate a way to live at peace with the people whose territory you are displacing them from. Destruction and annihilation are the only options. He adds, do not intermarry with them. Do not give your daughters to their sons or take their daughters for your sons, for they will turn your children away from following me to serve other gods. And the Lord's anger will be burned against you and will quickly destroy you if you do this. In other words, either you kill the non-Hebrews already living in the land that you are about to colonize, because that's what it was a colonization. If you don't do that, God will kill you. The Lord your God has chosen you out of all the peoples on the face of the earth to be his people, his treasured possession. So it's only a tiny step for racist individuals hiding behind the mask of Christianity to explain that if God encouraged the invasion of foreign territory and the execution of its inhabitants in the Torah, then it must be a sanctioned behavior at any future time for the glory of God. In conclusion, blatant Christian racism goes much farther than general tribalism in targeting people for mistreatment, not just because they're part of a different group or because they think differently, but because racism views itself as inherently superior, and the others, all others, as inherently inferior, as ordained by God's purpose and plan, taking the land that belongs to others by violence, purchasing or capturing other humans and forcing them to labor for you while breaking up their family units, enforcing strict limits on which others can live within your territory based upon skin color or race, are all ideologies that can find support within the Jewish and Christian scriptures. So it is up to each of us to decide whether or not these are ethics that we support or denounce today. And if we reject these ethics, then we are expressing a belief that the Bible must be read not as the dictated voice of God, but as the inspired statements of fallible men grasping at ways to explain their relationship with their God and the fragile world around them. Next time, as I said, we'll celebrate the achievement of great Christian activists who challenged these racist concepts with even greater, more grace-filled and enlightened biblical principles and teachings.